You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 9th of December 2016 on Monocle 24.
Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Andrew Muller. On today's show, why are Canadians saying, "I thought you invited him," to each other about US Vice President Joe Biden? My guests Tom Edwards, Daniel Giacopelli, Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Thomas Lewis will be here to discuss that and the day's other big stories, including the unceasing spread of fake news and the equally unceasing discussion of what might be done about it, the passing of John Glenn and whether the ideal of the national hero passed along with him, and Scandinavia's latest televisual sensation. Is the English-speaking world finally ready to embrace subtitles? That's all coming up on Midori House on Monocle 24 right now. So, welcome to Midori House. My guests today are a substantial portion of the population of Northern Europe, specifically Monocle 24 executive producer Tom Edwards, Monocle 24 producer Daniel Giacopelli, Monocle's Eurovision desk chief Fernando Augusto Pacheco, and joining us from our Toronto bureau, our bureau chief Thomas Lewis. Welcome all. And it is to Canada we turn first in an attempt to answer the riddle presently bedeviling the local political and media classes. What is Joe Biden doing here? The U.S. Vice President has been visiting Ottawa for reasons which appear to surpass the understanding of most onlookers. Assuming the Vice President does not plan to be the first of a deluge of Americans claiming asylum ahead of the swearing-in of Donald Trump, to what does Canada owe this honour? Thomas Lewis, you are in Canada, where I'm sure it is literally all anybody is talking about. Do you have any ideas?
Yes, I've heard on the grapevine that he's sort of measuring up the curtains in a rather nice little pad in Ottawa, apparently. No, I mean, I think, you know, everyone sort of loves Joe Biden here, speaking very broadly, so I don't think people are complaining too much. People are slightly baffled about, you know, why he's here. I mean, lots of sort of thoughts, I guess, kind of is it sort of a sort of soft touch, if you like, just to reassure the Canadians that obviously the political climate is about to change pretty dramatically come January the 20th, but, you know, reassuring Canada that it still remains one of the US's kind of key allies and a neighbor, of course, as well. I mean, I think, you know, Joe Biden is very good at this kind of, you know, cheery kind of brand of diplomacy. And I think in a way that's something, you know, Canada's getting quite used to, too, in the form of Justin Trudeau. So, you know, I guess, you know, if it's a partnership that maybe fits a bit better than say, or more obviously say, than say a Trump-Trudeau sort of partnership that we'll see, you know, from next year on. You know, it's been quite, you know, everything, there's been no expense spared really for Joe Biden's visit, I think it's fair to say. He had the red carpet rolled out for him. He had a big dinner last night. He's having talks with Justin Trudeau today. He's also met leaders of the First Nations communities here, which again, I think is something that, you know, for those communities in Canada will be a really sort of significant acknowledgement really from the US. Obviously, the relationship between those communities and the Canadian government is going through quite an important time, with many investigations into abuses by Canadian governments past towards those communities still ongoing, and the reconciliation process still ongoing too. So no, it's quite an interesting visit, as you say, a bit of a head scratcher, but one that Canadians are embracing, I think it's fair to say.
Danny, speaking as we often ask you to do on behalf of all 350 million of your fellow country folk, that point of Thomas's that everybody loves Joe Biden. He has become sort of a national uncle, hasn't he, as vice president?
Yeah, he makes funny comments. Some are a bit off color. He's jokey. He seems genuine. Not that many people dislike him. And yeah, Uncle Joe Biden. And he might run for president in a couple of years. Maybe.
I mean, Tom Edwards, this has been floated and has been walked back a bit by Biden himself, the idea of Biden 2020. He would be 77. Is that too old to run for president?
Frankly, Yes, I think he missed his chance. We know that there were some sad personal circumstances surrounding his withdrawal ultimately from this race. And a lot of people say, maybe quite rightly, that he might have won had he sort of fought for the White House this time. What strikes me as analogous with his trip to Canada a little bit is Biden's a bit like at a house party, someone who arrives, no one's quite sure who this one person is. They brought a nice bottle, they're quite charming, but nobody knows what they're there for. And that in the pictures, that's what struck me. I wonder whether Biden's like sort of somehow uninvited guest, but maybe he makes a few friends that he keeps.
Fernando, assuming if he decided to add Brazil, for example, to his farewell tour, would he be welcome there? Has the cult of Joe Biden spread to South America?
Absolutely. Well, of course, Obama is very popular in Brazil, and Joe Biden, you know, especially, you know, I've been reading quite a few articles on him, especially recently on Folha de São Paulo, all the major papers as well. But I have to agree with Tom. I hope he doesn't try to become the candidate of the Democratic presidential election in 2020. I think he will be quite old, 77. So I'm not being ageist here, but I think it's over.
I'm not being ageist, but he's too old.
But I am. But it's funny, in the National Post, there was an article, a very funny article written by John Iveson about Biden's trip, and they called it a Seinfeldian trip about nothing. And they say, literally, they interview all these people, and it says, nobody knows what, you know, WTF is he doing here? It's a Seinfeldian visit. And they cleared out the Christmas tree in Center Block's rotunda on Parliament Hill, lest an assailant hide amid the fairy lights and leap out and attack him. But they talked to all these people. People generally are happy that he's there, but nobody really knew why he chose now a lame duck vice president. You know, what's he doing in Canada?
Finally and briefly on this one, Thomas, in Toronto, has Canada yet got used to the idea of actual president, actual Donald, actual Trump, which is now barely over a month away?
No, I don't think they have, actually. There's still a lot of head scratching, to put it lightly, about that, too. I mean, I think, you know, it's we're seeing some quite interesting things, I think, sort of happening already from Canada's point of view. Obviously, the relationship with Mexico seems to be, you know, gaining potency from Ottawa's point of view. We had a visit from the Mexican president not that long ago. And, you know, when Trump won, the two leaders in Canada and Mexico apparently called each other before calling Trump, just to sort of see if they could get their messages straight, basically. Obviously, NAFTA is very important to both Canada and to Mexico, to, you know, speaking very broadly. But I think, you know, Donald Trump's assertions that he would renegotiate this kind of terrible deal is obviously, you know, a concerning thing. I think from a Canadian point of view, though, too, might be an interesting economic story to keep an eye out for. This notion of the Keystone XL pipeline, which was obviously shelved by President Obama. Donald Trump had said during the campaign that he would look at that again. That's a really controversial issue, actually, in Canada itself. The economic benefits short term are being touted as something quite significant, but obviously the environmental impact of that pipeline would be huge, so its opponents say. So, yes, lots of sort of dust in the air still, really, from Canada's point of view, I think, about a Trump presidency, as you say, which begins in about a month's time.
Well, let's look now at the country that Joe Biden will shortly cease being vice president of. While the idea of President Donald Trump still seems like a satirical online hoax that has been taken at face value in the real world, his election appears to be one of a dwindling number of verifiable facts on which people agree, and even then only after a certain amount of harumphing about Hillary Clinton's hefty margin in the popular vote. Clinton herself has spoken this week about the danger of fake news, which, among other wretched consequences, appears to have inspired a shooting in a Washington pizzeria from which the defeated candidate was alleged, in some quarters, to be masterminding a paedophile ring. Tom Edwards, isn't the problem here the eternal human problem that people will just go ahead and believe what it is that they want to believe?
Fundamentally, Andrew, of course, yeah, you're right. That's true. And, you know, especially in America where, the tabloid press, for example, means something very different from the red tops in this country. They are scandal sheets, they're jokey, they are almost satirical in their obvious fictions. I think what's troubled people this time around is where there's been a blurring of the line between, what would we call it, social media campaigning and fake news. And I think one thing that concerns some is the role that platforms or certain big digital players can play or are willing to play in regulating the content that they host and from which they profit via advertising. Now, we know that they can be, in some cases, quite small-c conservative about content, blanking out nudity or sanctioning certain things that they find to potentially be damaging, particularly to their advertisers. And yet, sometimes there's an unwillingness to get involved in what I guess they say is a political process. And I think that's where people find that there's a double standard. The technology does exist to regulate some of these things better, but it's not in their commercial interest necessarily to do it. And people say, well, look, there's maybe a hypocrisy at the heart of it.
To follow that up, Tom, does the law need to start? Because I don't know myself what I think about this. The argument of social media platforms is merely they are conduits, they enable communication, and they're no more culpable than, say, the telephone network would be if two people use a telephone call to plot, you know, a crime. Do they or should they now be regarded as actual publishers? Because, of course, if Monocle magazine were to publish, or indeed Monocle 24 were to broadcast any old honking nonsense that we just made up about, say, somebody running a paedophile ring out of a pizzeria in Washington, we would be accountable for that. We could be sued for it. Should Facebook and Twitter and other social media platforms be held accountable the same way?
I would say, Andrew, suspend your uncertainty. They squarely put themselves, they consider themselves in that light. They consider themselves to be, how often they talk about content, they consider themselves to be content providers. They editorialize. And they're big shots are quite happy to talk about them being the providers of news and offering services of journalism. And I think if they are going to style themselves in that way, then part of the responsibility that comes with that freedom is to ensure that you deliver some kind of editorial standard. And I don't think it's acceptable for them to say we're merely a conduit when in the next breath they style themselves as, you know, the all-around media platform of tomorrow. I think they answer your question for you.
Fernando, is this a global problem? Is this one of those things that starts in America, as so many things do, and then goes global?
Well, I think, to be honest, I'm not sure if it started in America, because I have to be really honest here. I was a victim of it. As you know, in Brazil, the society is also very hyper-partisan, especially during the process of impeachment of President Dilma. And I have to be honest here. I've shared in my social media an article that a friend of mine told me that actually was fake. But, you know, I was at the heat of the moment, and I did, and I felt very embarrassed by it. So at the same time, I understand what Tom says, that, you know, those companies, they are responsible for it. But you can't really, I think it's difficult to compare Facebook to a magazine, let's say. I think it's much harder. I mean, it's so vast. I mean, they have, I don't know, a billion users. I think it's very hard to control what every single person posts in there. So, you know, it's terrible, the fake news, but I think it's very hard to control. You know, I have to be careful, because I'm always scared of any type of censorship as well.
We have learned a lot, haven't we, Danny, about the way that people tend to react viscerally and emotionally to news stories rather than analytically. That symptom that Fernando mentions just there is you sort of read something, go, oh my God, and then hit forward, and then it might occur to you 10 minutes later to think, actually, now that I think of it, I'm not. Because everybody's susceptible to a certain extent, and it has now just become more accelerated by social media, hasn't it?
Yeah, it's like that photo that keeps going around in which Trump supposedly said to People magazine in 1998, you know, if I ran for president as a Republican, they would just eat this up and those idiot Republicans. And that's just so abundantly fake. And yet it still keeps going around. And you could say, well, should Facebook's algorithm make that photo less likely to appear? I don't know. I mean, again, that gets into censorship. I think these companies have a responsibility, though, to make their algorithms recognize what is truly fake and what's not truly fake. Also, advertisers, like you were saying, Tom, I mean, there was an article this morning. What happens when, you know, an advertiser appears alongside a fake article? Because often a completely independent algorithm determines where they're placed. And, you know, would Chevy want to be placed alongside an article that says, you know, Obama is a lizard reptilian man? No.
Are you saying he's not?
Well, I'm not denying or saying it. But you know, I mean, it really, it's their money, too. So they have a vested interest in not being placed alongside this stuff, too. And it's just bad for democracy. But again, you don't want to be censored.
Thomas, is there an issue of education here as well? I think it's easy when you approach this story from inside the media as well to forget that if you've spent your life working inside the media, you get, well, hopefully you get pretty good at spotting the thing, the detail in a story that seems a little bit off that makes you think, really, where there is still an assumption, isn't there, I think, among a lot of people, that if you see something on a screen, if you see something in writing, you assume that it must be there for a reason, that, you know, that people wouldn't just make this up, that it must have some basis in fact.
Yes, absolutely. And I think it's that sort of ease, you know, with which, you know, both these things appear, but also then obviously that you share them around and, you know, kind of perpetuate this bubble, I guess, of kind of news or things that you're sort of, you know, predisposed to sort of already. I mean, I think there was quite an interesting point made kind of in the aftermath, you know, a couple of days after the US election, where, you know, obviously there was a lot of sort of questioning of journalism and how journalism had failed in sort of picking up on these themes that were obviously sort of roiling in various parts of the country. And the point was made that, you know, traditional sort of newspapers, and this is something we cover a lot here, of course, you know, are sort of hemorrhaging cash, you know, and don't have the budgets they once had to go and have reporters embedded in a town somewhere, or going to sort of do a sort of story just to go on a fact-finding mission, if you like, to gauge the temperature and the mood of things. So, you know, I think there, that's kind of a bigger question of sort of, you know, how we make sure journalism stands up when, you know, financial considerations, you know, make that sort of very core practice kind of maybe harder to achieve, really.
Okay, well, we're going to take a short break now. You are listening to Midori House here with me, Andrew Muller, along with Thomas Lewis, Fernando Augusto Pacheco, Daniel Giacopelli, and Tom Edwards. Coming up next, John Glenn. Will they make them like that anymore?
Weighing in at almost 400 pages, the Monocle Guide to Cozy Homes is packed with everything you need to know about making a great place to live. The book is filled with handsome residences and all the contacts you need to make a home that will last a lifetime. And it's a book that celebrates the people who know homes should be able to cope with kids, dogs, and a few scuff marks too. It's a book that knows a home is only as good as the community it's in. And it's a book that takes you through the front doors of everything from mountain hideaways to modernist towers. So be cozy and buy your copy today at monocle.com.
You are back with Midori House on Monocle 24 with me, Andrew Muller. Still with me, Fernando Augusto Pacheco, Thomas Lewis, Daniel Giacopelli, and Tom Edwards. Now, it is difficult to regard the death of John Glenn as tragic, exactly. He was 95 years old at the end of a life as impressive, important, and valorous as might be imagined. He was a combat pilot who earned 6 Distinguished Flying Crosses in the Pacific and Korea, the first man to fly across America faster than sound, the first American in space, a long-serving senator, and at the age of 77, the oldest person back in orbit, and quite possibly America's oldest licensed pilot, only persuaded to sell his twin-engined Beechcraft when he was 90. But Glenn's passing does prompt the thought that the old-school national hero, as Glenn assuredly was, might itself be a dying breed. Do we now know too much? Can we admire anyone so uncritically anymore? Daniel Giacopelli, American living national heroes of Glenn's stature. Does anyone leap to mind?
Well, I have to say, about the oldest living pilot, my grandfather was a pilot, and he is still alive, and he flew a plane a couple of years ago. We took him up for one of his birthdays, actually, in an old, I guess, 1950s. I forgot the type of plane, but he went up there. He's pretty old, so let's not be ageist about pilots here. No, he's nearing. Well, he's up there. But does anybody come to mind now? If you stick in the pilot realm, I guess you could say Sully Sullenberger. There's a movie made about him. Tom Hanks plays him. Tom Hanks plays heroes generally.
Well, exactly. That pretty much seals it, doesn't it? If played by Tom Hanks, you're in the pantheon.
Yeah. Who else? I mean, I found a list here on some dubiously named Conservapedia website. Gallery.
This can only go
Gallery
well.
Of American Heroes. They put Joe Arpaio, the controversial American sheriff, but I don't think he belongs on this list.
Controversial's doing a lot of work there, Danny.
You know, in the age of social media, are there any heroes, or do we just kind of scroll by them as we do and say, oh, there's another person who did something good, but we don't really like kind of laud them as we once did.
Because I was trying to think of somebody from my native Australia who would be that sort of universally regarded figure. I could only think of Sir Donald Bradman, the great cricket player who died a few years ago. But certainly up until the point at which he died, he would have been thought of as the greatest living Australian.
But is he a hero?
Is it
the same thing?
No, not. I mean, he didn't actually go into space or anything, or you know, win the Distinguished Flying Cross six times. But within his own field, certainly. So Tom Edwards, the British aren't as keen on the idea of the national hero.
Well, I think in the sort of, you know...
You're a sceptical people.
Well, in the post-empire world, we've always been a little more reticent about blowing our own horn. There's two things that strike me. One is this idea about what is truly heroic. I think it's a word that's been devalued. But on the idea of national hero specifically, is a particular kind of man, and I think Glenn could be one of the last, certainly of the US brand, and that's a truly... a polymathic character, somebody who achieves to an extraordinary level in a number of different walks of life, often very conspicuously different in the demands they make of an individual. And obviously I would say someone like a Winston Churchill as a 20th century titan showed those virtues. If we're looking maybe here in Britain, my own country, there aren't many to choose from. We've still got a couple going. I'd say somebody maybe like David Attenborough, who's obviously, you know, incredibly highly regarded naturalist, but an extraordinary broadcaster, a journalist, an originator, an innovator. He has had amazing, enduring success over, what, more than half a century in a kind of John Glennish way, and managed to achieve to an extraordinary level of proficiency in several different things. But he's, I mean, almost one of a kind, and he himself must be, I think he's in his 90s now, so...
Just about, I think, yes.
There aren't many left, and I wonder whether there's something about the pace of life now or the demands that people make that prevents somebody being given the... It prevents them having the sort of latitude to try their hand at other things and to learn that they have all of these other qualities.
Fernando, is there a Brazilian contender, or even from wider South America? Would Brazilians, the obvious one I'm thinking of, is would they put Pelé in that category?
Yeah, I thought a lot, you know, before doing the show that I would choose Pelé. But the thing is, I think his image is better abroad, outside Brazil, because, you know, I mean...
But that's that thing of us knowing less, isn't it? All we know of exactly. Pelé outside Brazil is... those World Cups and those fantastic clips of a beautiful, graceful football player.
Exactly. He had a very difficult, you know, life. I mean, his son was arrested because of, you know, drug possession. He also, at some point, he started doing some ads selling pills of erectile dysfunction.
We have seen that.
Exactly.
Around the world.
So it is quite interesting. So I wouldn't say that he's the Brazilian hero at the moment. Even our former president Lula, at times when he left power, he had 80% of approval. For a lot of people, especially in the poorest parts of Brazil, in the Northeast, he was considered a national hero. You can't say that now after all the corruption charges against him. So it is very hard to find. The only name that I could think of is of Brazilian actress Fernanda Montenegro. She's almost 90 years old now, and she's widely respected in Brazil by everyone. And she did very controversial roles very recently, playing an elderly lesbian woman in a soap opera with a kiss there. So I think she's, and she's quite vocal about you know, gay rights. She could be a hero.
I have one.
Go on.
Bob Dylan.
Yeah, not a bad call.
Who, I mean, really, who else in America right now?
Well, no, you...
Genuine titan of everything.
Yeah, definitely an arguable case. Thomas Lewis in Canada, I can hear you straining from here to throw in a couple of Welsh suggestions, which I'm going to allow you to do, mostly to annoy Tom Edwards.
Yes, well, there are so many to choose from. half an hour programme to that alone, Andrew, frankly. Do you know what? I'm going to say, well, I'll do a Canadian one and a Welsh one. Is that allowed?
Certainly.
Okay, so let's do Welsh first. So this is a bit of a kooky one, but there is a radio presenter called Betty George. She presents this radio show on the Welsh language radio station in Wales, and it's called Betty I Phobl, which basically translates to Betty and her people. And she basically travels around the country. It's such a sweet, sort of good-natured programme, meeting the good people of Wales.
I like
and
that.
It's absolutely lovely and kind of quite old-fashioned in its way, but it's still something that's, you know, part of the sort of national, for people who speak Welsh anyway, it's a part of the sort of national cultural backdrop, I think, to many of our lives.
Okay, well, quickly a Canadian one, because we have a vital discussion about Scandinavian television we have to get to as well.
Okay, so in that same theme, I think Rick Mercer actually might be quite a good candidate. He's a TV satirist. We profiled him in the Canada issue of Monocle magazine, and he does something similar. He has these monologues, these rants in the middle of his show, his weekly TV show. And again, this TV show is about travelling around Canada, meeting people. He's met prime ministers. He meets sort of lobster fishermen. It's kind of everyone in between. And people really sort of find him as this, it's obviously a very funny programme, but they find him as this kind of gauge of kind of the mood of the nation in many ways. And again, for very good-natured reasons, it's a very sort of warming kind of programme.
Okay, well, finally tonight, the baleful Scandinavian television drama has lately become such an institution that it's no longer merely a genre, but an instantly understood cliché. The latest to have acquired a following outside its native country is Norwegian youth drama Shame, whose online episodes have become so popular that its international fan base has petitioned for subtitles so that they don't have to watch pirate translations on YouTube, which are a thing, apparently. And an English-speaking remake is now in the works. The question is, which I guess I'll put to you first, Tom Edwards, why some shows are portable? Homeland, for example, was a slightly sillified version of a much better Israeli series called Prisoners of War, which is an underappreciated fact, I think.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, for a long time, just the concept of subtitling meant that something couldn't be a commercial success. And I think Fernando will probably tell us that we've seen elements of this on the big screen as well. Look, I welcome the fact that people are willing to look beyond their immediate borders for their cultural sustenance. And I like to see a bit of, activist commissioning. Is that what you'd call it? If a group of hungry viewers want to watch something that they've seen in a far-flung location. On the bigger point, I'm not quite sure. I always found it rather depressing that somebody wouldn't watch something simply because they sort of had to get two parts of their brain working.
And most,
at once.
Most foreign remakes of the original idea are terrible. The American Office, I think, was an exception, which I actually thought improved on the original in many respects.
Controversial.
There will, I'm sure, being at some point a dreadful American version of my favourite Norwegian programme of recent years, which is the sitcom DAG, which, if any listeners haven't heard it, I recommend unreservedly. It's about a misanthropic marriage counsellor. And it's brilliant, really genuinely very funny. Fernando, do you have any particular favourite translations or things that have been lifted from one arena to another, or even a Brazilian programme we should all be watching but aren't?
Well, to be honest, it's not recent, but of course, you know, the series Absolutely Fabulous, right? I mean, not many people know...
That wasn't actually Brazilian, was it?
That was not Brazilian?
No, I didn't think so.
In fact, they did a French version of it, Absolument Fabuleux, and it's, which is... It's true.
Spanish version was absoluto fabuloso.
Absolutely. And again, it was a lot of people hated. I liked it. You know, there was Jean-Paul Gaultier in it, Catherine Deneuve in a special cameo. So, you know, I think sometimes it brings the exotic. And I have another story for you. I don't know if you heard Bauer sucht Bauerin, which basically had a series, is a Swiss series, is Farmer Wants a Wife. And they had a British series in 2001.
There's been an Australian version of that as well. It's
exactly.
Terrible.
Thanks to the Swiss version.
Well, thanks, the Swiss.
The Dutch had a very good version as well.
Good Lord. Danny, do you have a particular favourite? Not a particular favourite version of Farmer Wants a Wife, though fine.
I watched the American remake of The Killing, the TV series, the Danish TV series. Danish, yeah, it's Danish, right? Scandinavian, let's just say. It was actually brilliant, the American one. Because they instead of in Scandinavia, they placed it in Seattle, which is basically the same thing. Gloomy, kind of, you know.
And bad coffee.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I enjoyed it a lot. And you know what? House of Cards, of course, is a remake of the British show, the American one. And
Didn't need subtitles.
Yeah, but it's still, they took it out of its
true
its
enough
geographic origin. And I hear Thomas Lewis wanting to pipe in there.
Yeah, I've got another Welsh suggestion, not to make this the Welsh.
Imagine our surprise, but do carry on.
It's not Thomas and his bubble, is it? Again?
A nice old woman who travels the country.
So there is a program called Y Gwyllt, which is translated into English as Hinterland. I'm not sure if you've seen this, because it is on sort of, you know, British television, the BBC. Must have missed it. Well, it's your loss, Tom, frankly. So this is a,
it'll be on catch up, Tom.
It is, and you should watch it, because it's brilliant, actually. And what they did was that they filmed three versions of this thing. So one entirely in Welsh, one entirely in English, and then a bilingual version. So it was broadcast on the Welsh language national broadcaster S4C first. Then it was broadcast on the BBC across the UK. And then there's a bilingual version that I believe the Danish state broadcaster bought the international broadcast rights to before even a single episode had been aired. And it's been this quite interesting model in how you have, you know, very old language, for example, like Welsh, but actually tapping into this kind of, you know, growing kind of appetite, I guess, around the world for these kind of quite moody sort of crime dramas set in these sort of beautiful landscapes.
Thomas, I think it's on its third series. Can I jump in? Can you confirm or deny that you once featured in an episode of Pobolicum, cult Welsh favourite situation programme?
I can confirm that. That's where my glittering career began, actually, Tom. That's where I like to trace it back to. Anyway, used to film the school seals in my school, so we used to have to go with our backpacks and stuff, walking past the teachers.
On that revelation, we will have to leave it there. Thomas Lewis, Tom Edwards, Daniel Giacopelli, Fernando Augusto Pacheco, thank you for joining us. Today's show was produced by Carlotta Rabello, research by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Naomi Joseph. Our studio manager was Toby Hammond. There's music next. Marcus Hippie with the menu at 1900. And I've got more on the main stories of the day on The Daily at 2200. For now, I'm Andrew Miller. Thanks for listening. Have a great weekend.